Thanks for, I guess particularly to Mitch Dechter and Mr. Campbell for arranging this conference. I think it's very important. And I'm glad to be here to participate. Now, the title of my talk is, maybe we want to call it the False Civil Rights Vision. And whether there's agreement on with my general ideas on racial issues or not, I think that we all can agree that for too large a segment of the black community, things are getting progressively worse. I think that those of us, many of us in this room, who fought or participated in the civil rights battles in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and that yielded the Brown versus the Board of Education, culminating in the Civil Rights Acts of 1964, we had every reasonable expectation that our racial problems would have been solved some four decades later. Indeed, there has been unprecedented progress. And I think that a lot of times we don't pay attention to the progress. Now, if I'm not being too chauvinistic, I think it's fair to say that black Americans as a group have made the greatest progress over some of the highest hurdles in the shortest span of time than any other racial group in the history of mankind. Let's look at a little bit of evidence for such a bold assertion. I think that if we were to think of black Americans just as a nation, within our nation, and add up the income that black Americans earn each year, and consider ourselves having a GNP, we would be the 13th or 14th richest nation in the world. Black Americans have been chief executives of some of the world's largest and richest cities. It was a black American in the person of Colin Powell who was the chief officer of the world's mightiest military and later Secretary of State. Black Americans rank among the world's most famous personalities. And a few black Americans are among the world's richest people. Now, some of the significance of this is that in 1865, neither a slave nor a slave owner would have believed that such an achievement would have been possible in the mere space of a century or so, if ever. And as such, these achievements speak well of the moral character and the intestinal fortitude of a people. But just as significantly, and we should not forget, the achievements also speak well of a nation in which these achievements were possible. That is, they would have been impossible anywhere else in the world. Now, despite these monumental gains, there's a large segment of the black community for whom these gains remain elusive. Moreover, given the status quo and the conventional wisdom, there's little prospect for progress. A large part of the problem is that of vision. That is, today's devastating problems among a large segment of the black community are either ignored or dealt with ineffectively as we focus too much attention and expend energies and resources on what were yesteryear's big problems. Let me be clear about what I'm saying. For all intents and purposes, The civil rights struggle in the United States is over and it's won. At one time, black Americans did not have the constitutional guarantees afforded other Americans. Today, that is not true. We have the same constitutional guarantees that every other American has. For the most part, if we have money, we can buy what we want and live wherever we want. Now, let me again be clear. I am not saying that every vestige of racial discrimination has been eliminated. Blacks, like other ethnic minorities, still encounter residual discrimination. But today's discrimination is insignificant compared to that of yesteryear, and it's irrelevant compared to other problems that black Americans have. Let me just spend a few minutes talking about these other problems. One major problem is, a devastating problem, is family breakdown. We've all heard that term used. I don't quite use it all the time. What's often called family breakdown is not the proper description. It's families not forming in the first place. Today, less than 40% of black children have the benefit of growing up in a home with both parents. There's an illegitimacy rate of almost 75%, somewhere between 70 and 75%. Now, you don't have to morally condemn single parenthood in order to acknowledge that it's better for children to be reared in a two-parent family. Not only are children who are raised by single parents 5 times more likely to be poor, they're more likely to do poorly in school, become dropouts, engage in antisocial behavior, and become single parents themselves. Now, it is difficult to lay the breakdown of the black family at the feet of racial discrimination, in light of the fact that as early as the mid-1800s, let's say, I didn't mean mid-1800s, let's say around 1875, 1880, 75 to 90%, depending on what city you're looking at, of black children lived in two-parent families. Even during slavery, more black children were raised in two-parent households, whether the parents could legally marry or not, it's another question, but more black children were raised in two-parent families during slavery than now. Another devastating problem that has little or nothing to do with racial discrimination is the high rate of crime in the black community. The high rate of crime takes a devastating toll on black neighborhoods. It has the full effect of a law mandating that there shall be little or no economic development in black neighborhoods. It acts as a massive tax on those least able to pay. Because of high crime, because of the costs associated with high crime, businesses such as supermarkets and banks are reluctant to locate in high crime neighborhoods. That means that poor people in those neighborhoods must bear the additional cost of transportation to downtown shopping centers or to suburban malls, or settle for the high prices charged at ma-and-pa shops. You might recall that after the Los Angeles riots, we saw interviews with people, interviews with black people, and they were complaining about the absence of supermarkets in neighborhoods, in their neighborhoods, and the necessity to use check cashing stands and pay a high premium to cash their paycheck. They were wrong in blaming banks and blaming supermarket owners for not coming to their neighborhoods. They should blame the thugs that made banking and supermarket operations a more costly proposition in black neighborhoods. I had a friend in Philadelphia, he since died, Al Morris, who was the vice president of a major Philadelphia bank, and he told me that he had to pay workers the equivalent of combat pay to work in some neighborhoods. Now, you're going to have to sit me down a long time to convince me that white supermarket owners and white bank owners don't like green dollars coming out of black hands. It's another observation that you can make, if you care to tonight, go a few blocks up to where I used to live, and that is the way that businesses are done in black neighborhoods. By the way, I wouldn't suggest that you go up there. My daughter sometimes asked me, would I take her in, where I grew up? And I told her, as soon as I can rent an armored personnel carrier, preferably with a periscope. But if you see the way that businesses are conducted in some black neighborhoods, you'll see guards in supermarkets. You'll see restricted access to products, higher prices, less convenient hours, and lower quality merchandise. These are all methods of the store owner to respond to the higher costs of doing business. And all these costs must be passed on to the consumer. Another devastating problem that has nothing to do with racial discrimination is education. The devastating, I call it fraudulent education, that most black Americans, most black children receive, has strong socioeconomic implications. And again, they can hardly be laid at the feet of racial discrimination. In fact, to make this point, bring this point home a little bit better, some of the worst education that black Americans receive are delivered in cities, in the very cities where a black is the mayor, a black is the superintendent of schools, most of the principals and teachers are black. Talking about cities like Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia, and Detroit. Now, I'm not saying stating a causal relationship between race and this poor quality of education. I'm saying that you cannot lay it at the feet of discrimination. Now, more money is not the answer. But there's nearly a perfect negative correlation between the amount of money spent and the quality of education. If you look at cities like New Jersey, New York, and Washington, D.C., they spend more education dollars than any other jurisdiction in the country. Washington, D.C. Spends, depending on whose calculations you're looking at, anywhere between $13,000 and $15,000 per kid. And where do you think Washington shows up nationally on academic achievement? Well, I tell you, probably the people in Washington, D.C., they are hoping that Mississippi does not secede from the Union. Otherwise, they'd be dead last. Now, what fraudulent education does, it has made many black youngsters virtually useless for the increasingly high-tech world of the 21st century. Most black youngsters who, in fact, graduate from high school, as Abigail Thernstrom and her husband have documented, have an academic achievement level around that of a white youngster who's in the seventh or eighth grade. Black politicians, along with the education establishment, they call for everything from more money, busing, Afrocentrism, to improve education. Their vision of what needs to be done has failed. I think part of the solution is to examine those islands of success in poor black neighborhoods, those islands of success where there is academic achievement. Go to places like Marcus Garvey School in Los Angeles, Marva Collins Preparatory School in Cincinnati, or Ivy Leaf right up on North Broad Street in Philadelphia. And at each of these schools I mentioned, 95% of the kids, 90 to 95% of the kids score at and sometimes 3 and 4 years above grade level. And if you visit these schools, you would see no magic. You would see nothing that the Board of Education, that the education establishment says is necessary for the academic achievement of black kids. What you would see is that kids come to school in the morning, ready for education. They've left their knives and guns at home. They come to school sober, and the parents reinforce the teachers. And by the way, their annual tuition ranges anywhere from $3,000 to $4,000, a fraction of what the government schools charge. One final area that we need to look at, and that has to do with entry restrictions. Those of you who are familiar with some of my research know I've written a lot on the artificial barriers to entry in jobs and businesses that have devastating effects. One that I've paid particular attention to is occupational licensing. And the taxi business is one business that lends itself to people with a relatively poor education. But in New York, you have to have a in most places, you have to have a license. And in New York, the license, they call a medallion in New York, to own and operate one taxi is $275,000. Now you say, well, what is the effect of that? Well, it tends to discriminate against those getting in the taxi business who don't have $275,000 or bank credit to get such a loan for that, and that tends to be people with a little change. But I'll tell you one thing, I'm very pleased when I go to New York that there's the number of gypsy cabs, illegally operating cabs, exceeds the number of licensed cabs. Matter of fact, I think it's medallion cabs in New York is 11,787, and some of the estimates about the gypsy cabs run as high as 14,000. And when I was doing research on for my book on occupational licensing, I used to go up to New York on other business, but I used to go to places like Bronx and Harlem, and on the side of some of these gypsy cabs, they used to have words written, a little banner saying, "We're not yellow, we go anywhere." And probably they had some kind of anti-crime technique available to them. let me close by saying that most of what needs to be done to solve the problems of a large segment of the black community can't be done by government. If you look at, if you ask yourself questions, what's necessary for a kid to get in school, to do well in school? Well, somebody has to make sure he goes to bed on time. Somebody has to wake him up in the morning. Somebody has to make him do his homework. Which one of those things can the United States Congress do? They can't do anything. Now, what the General Society can do to help is not make matters worse. That is, insist on high standards as opposed to lowered standards through affirmative action or guilty responses, as Shelby Steele was talking about last night. By the way, speaking of guilt, this is just a little benefit from attending this meeting. On my website, under gifts, I have a proclamation for amnesty and pardon to all white Americans for both their own grievances and those of their forebears against my people. And if you read it carefully, it says that now that you have this pardon, you can stop feeling guilty. It's free so far. Another, okay, so insist on high standards. Remove subsidies and other incentives for slovenly behavior. That is, it's cheap. Society has made it cheap to have kids out of wedlock. Society's made it cheap to, or less costly, not to get a job, to be a bum. And so what we need to do is to, that's what society, general society can do, is to remove subsidies and other incentives for slovenly behavior. We also need to stigmatize drugs and crime in trying to, instead of trying to explain them away, or instead of trying to say, oh, well, that's just the way they act. I think we need to stigmatize bizarre behavior. You know, I know I don't look like it, but I'm 68 years old. Probably most of you think I'm early 30s, something like that. But some of the things that I see going on today, and I imagine not just black people, but if I could resurrect my grandmother and tell her some of the things that go on today, she would not believe you. You know, where people using foul language, even girls using foul language, and people just kind of accepting it, or looking like bums, you know, wearing these long T-shirts and bummy pants. If I were an employer, I wouldn't even talk to somebody interviewing for a job like that. And I think that what we need to do is to stigmatize behavior, because the kind of accepting lower standards doesn't do anybody any good, whether it's lower standards in employment or in education. Matter of fact, I tell people one of the most fortunate things that happened to me is that I am glad that I got all of my education before it became fashionable for white people to like black people. And so, which means that the C that I got in college was an honest to God, hard worked for C. And but many black Americans don't have that opportunity. At UCLA, where I got my doctorate in economics, when the PhD exam was given, the written, 16 people took it and 13 flunked it. I was among the ones that flunked it. And Professor Lanniford, who was one of my advisors, he told me, Williams, your test was among the worst. Can you imagine, not that many white teachers would tell a black kid that nowadays. And that doesn't help. So let me stop there, and I welcome any questions you might have.